Albert Hall for this evening's prom, and Katie Derham.
Sean, good evening, thank you. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for the culmination of our celebrations of the bicentenary of Schumann's birth. We are going to hear his introduction and Allegro Appassionato, which pianist Fanine Collins is going to play. Also a world premiere of a reworking and enclosing of a rarely heard song cycle by Schumann, given a new set of clothes and surroundings by Robin Holloway. More about that a little later. And we'll also hear from two composers whose music Schumann loved, Schubert and Mozart. And all will be performed by the BBC Philharmonic, playing tonight under the baton of their chief conductor, Gianandrea Noseda. Schumann described Mozart's G minor symphony number 40 as being filled with Grecian lightness and effortless grace. But to begin with this evening, we have another minor key symphony by a composer Schumann particularly championed, Schubert. Now, his unfinished symphony has been a constant favourite here at the proms, and theories abound as to why Schubert never returned to the score, only two movements of which he completed 6 years before he died. Most seem to agree it can't possibly be that he thought it was fine in its two-movement shape. More likely, perhaps, he was simply too busy, or that it reminded him of a time in his life when he first started to get really very ill with the syphilis, which would eventually kill him. There's another reason for the rather mythic reputation to this piece. People didn't know it existed for a long time, as Schubert gave the completed two movements to the director of the Styrian Music Society, who promptly shoved them in a drawer and forgot about them, and they languished there for years until discovered, well, nearly 40 years later. The work was finally performed in 1865. The symphony's haunting music captures the imagination of audiences whenever it's played, and tonight should be no exception. Schubert, of course, one of those composers whose body of work you can only look at now in awe, a man who died so extremely young, only 31, a giant of the Romantic movement in the 19th century. The catalogue of his music, made by Otto Deutsch almost 60 years ago, numbers just under 1,000 works. Songs, song cycles, symphonies, chamber music, piano music, quite a lot of it left in an unfinished state. Interestingly, though, no concertos. Well, as we wait for the leader of the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra to come onto the stage, let me tell you a little bit about the conductor of tonight's prom, Gianandrea Noseda, the chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, and he has a string of other conducting posts throughout Europe, but he takes his relationship with this one extremely seriously. The round of applause there for Helena Wood, guest leader of the BBC Philharmonic tonight. But no, Gianandrea Noseda, very closely working with this orchestra. He's involved in recordings, concerts at the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, throughout the Northwest, lots of touring. They've just come back from Germany indeed. And here he is now coming to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall for this marvellous Schumann-themed prom. But first, the wonderful unfinished symphony, number 8 in B minor by Franz Schubert. the beautiful, serene end to Schubert's unfinished 8th symphony in G minor. A very warm reception here in another sold-out Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Philharmonic playing with great sensitivity in that second movement, and conducted by Gianandrea Noseda with his customary passion and intensity. Franz Schubert was dubbed by Liszt as the most poetic of composers. He was the heir to the great Viennese classical tradition, if you like, and the quintessential composer of early Romanticism. And though he died in 1828, he wasn't really discovered until 1839, when the man of the evening, Robert Schumann, came across the manuscript of the unperformed Great C Major Symphony, No. 9, and quickly arranged a concert at the Leipzig Gewandhaus under Mendelssohn. Well, we are here to celebrate Schumann tonight, and as the stage is reset, let's hear from Gianandrea Noseda about Schumann's reputation, because we've heard all the Schumann symphonies at the proms this season, which might convince those doubters who sometimes mutter that Schumann's orchestral music is a bit of a turn-off for concert goers. I spoke to tonight's conductor earlier this afternoon.
Always Schumann has been seen as a composer, orchestral composer, like a weak composer, which absolutely is not true. And when I performed Schumann 4th Symphony 3 weeks ago at the proms, the reaction of the audience has been spectacular, very sympathetic and very enthusiastic. So I don't think it's something connected with the quality of the music. Probably a sort of heritage of beginning of the 20th century. Oh, it was not orchestrated like Brahms or like Strauss or like... He was Schumann, he was not Brahms. That's why he's different. Yeah, that's my point of view.
Gianandrea Noseda, tonight's conductor, talking to me earlier this afternoon. Well, in the second half of tonight's prom, we're going to be hearing a new piece based around some of Schumann's songs, and the piece is written by Robin Holloway, and earlier he explained his deep love for Schumann's music.
Well, I came to Schumann rather late, actually. I suppose I must have learnt lovely little piano pieces that everyone learning the piano learns, and of course you love them. But actually, he was quite a late discovery. And I came sort of forward from the classics and backwards from the moderns and the high romantics. And Schumann was kind of last. There's something unique about the intimacy, about the way he speaks, seemingly directly to everyone who listens. And I'm sure that's because, as we know, he was addressing one person in most of his earliest and greatest music. It was all for Clara. And it's kept that quality of intimate address. It just goes to places that the other bears don't reach.
Robin Holloway there, and we'll be hearing more from him later, talking about the piece that he's worked around Schumann's songs from text by Mary Queen of Scots, and that piece is called Reliquary. Next tonight, though, we're going to hear a piece by the man himself, by Schumann. It hasn't been heard here at the proms since 1978, and it's his introduction and Allegro Appassionato, one of the few works that Schumann wrote for piano and orchestra. It seems strange when he had that inspirationally gifted pianist Clara for a wife that he didn't write more. She was such a huge champion of his piano music, not just the solo work, but the orchestral stuff too. But he wrote just one piano concerto. He argued that he felt piano works with orchestra worked better in one movement, and indeed, that is how the piece that we're about to hear is constructed. Having said that, there are two very distinct parts, as the title implies, a slow introduction and a main allegro. He wrote it in 1849. He was immersed in Byron at the time. It was just when he'd been writing his Manfred overture. You may have remember seeing that performed by the Royal Liverpool Phil earlier on in the season. The soloist tonight is Fineann Collins, a young Irish pianist born in Dublin, discovered when he won the 1999 Clara Haskell International Piano Competition in Switzerland. A very enthusiastic fan of Schumann, greatly admired for his recordings of Schumann, and he's been playing the Schumann Piano Concerto indeed regularly this year. And he was telling me earlier how much he really did feel that he thinks about the songs that Schumann wrote as well for his darling wife when he's playing. He feels it's that very vocal line. He's coming onto the stage now with tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Noseda, to perform Schumann's Allegro and Introduction Appassionato with BBC Philharmonic. Schumann's Introduction and Allegro Appassionato, a piece not heard here at the Proms for more than 30 years. Performed there by young Irish pianist Fineann Collins with the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Gianandrea Noseda. A tempestuous, angst-filled piece, Byronic, as I was saying. Schumann very much influenced by the works of Lord Byron when he was writing that. Fineann Collins told me earlier that he loves the sort of stream of consciousness feel of Schumann's work, the way the moods and emotions constantly change. And my word, he lived and breathed every mood in that piece. A very physical player, almost leaping out of his seat at times, even when he wasn't playing, just listening to the orchestra. Very warmly received here. Brought back onto the stage by the conductor, Gianandrea Noseda, and bringing the whole orchestra to its feet. It's his second appearance at the Proms. He told me earlier how much he'd enjoyed his first experience, having the Prommers smiling up at him from so close by. He's coming back out onto the stage now with Gianandrea Noseda to take another bow. Exciting performance we've just heard from Fineann Collins. After this, he's going to be preparing for his very own piano festival, which he runs in Ireland. A very enthusiastic character, very cheerful. Gianandrea Noseda now bringing the wind section to their feet, and now the whole orchestra as well. Well, as the soloist and conductor leave the stage, I think for the last time, it's time for me to tell you about the second half. We're going to be hearing a new arrangement of Schumann's songs by Robin Holloway and Mozart's 40th Symphony as well. But now we have reached the interval in our prom tonight. And on Saturday night, tonight's orchestra, the BBC Philharmonic, plays a prom in the park near to its new home in Salford. And to celebrate, the poet Andrew Malik visits Buell Hill Park, where that concert is happening. And walking in the footsteps of Lowry, she draws on her childhood experiences of park life.
My earliest memory of being in a park is of a palm tree with a man suspended against the trunk, picking fresh dates from under the arching green fronds. My dad calls to him in Arabic. The man passes us handfuls of the delicious syrupy fruit, and we continue towards our picnic. I am walking in Buell Hill Park, Salford, a long way from my childhood Arabian memories. We are celebrating the proms in the park, people coming together in anticipation with picnics, loved ones. We will all be joined by the music, the performance, being out in the open, enjoying the green space, fresh air, sharing food, drink, surroundings. Tonight, Salford resembles the artist Lowry's painting, The Bandstand, on another Salford night in a different century. But we are the same. When it comes to going out to the park, the rituals remain unchanged, the freedom it brings to be out here under the skies. For me, parks have always been an important part of my life, from childhood to womanhood, moving countries, changing cities. This one family tradition has stayed constant throughout. And now, as a writer, it is an essential part of my daily routine to walk out towards the green and inviting, taking the fresh, renew, stimulate, invigorate, return to work inspired by the two parks I live in between, near where Lowry was born. My My birthplace was in Qatif Oasis along the Persian Gulf in Dahran, where my father worked for an Arab American oil company as an accountant. It was a regular occurrence, us going to the park with picnics packed. Mum, Dad, siblings, often aunties and uncles, whole groups of us, talking, laughing. The rustle of the palm trees all around us as we picked our way through the sand to our spot. I'm a little girl with a pretty frilly frock, lovingly sewn at home by my mother, with matching ribbons threaded through my two pigtails, plaited perfectly, complete with neat little bows. On my feet, I have black patent shoes. My look is finished with black coal lining my eyes. Surma, good for sight. I run alongside the grown-ups, face alight with excitement and a big smile. My younger sister is not far behind, an exactly matching outfit, hair, shoes, and the ribbons. Mum and Dad look like film stars. Mum in shalwar kameez, her dupatta flowing down her shoulder, her pointy designer sunglasses perched fashionably on her nose. Dad beside her, hair combed to a tousled look, short-sleeved shirt, loose summer trousers, both so in love and happy. We move countries, continents, languages changed, surroundings, the weather, but trips to the parks continued. In Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, in England, our lives in the open air sustained throughout. In Al Khubba, we sat by the sea, the park behind us. In Riyadh, we walked along the city's park. In Bahrain, we were never far from the sea. When I was 7, my grandfather, Babaji, wrote a letter to my dad from Pakistan. He said he found it hard to have one of his 5 sons so far away. He did not want to die without seeing his family back home. My father could not ignore the tug of the letter, and we moved to Pakistan. We lived in a house newly and lovingly built, especially for us, with all the wooden fittings made by Babaji, the carpenter. Our home was in the new satellite town, between Rawalpindi, where my parents are from, and Islamabad. From there, we travelled far and wide for our park visits, from a nearby little village, Firashan, to Taxla Hills, by one of the tallest Buddha statues in northern Pakistan, and Shalimar Gardens in Lahore. The picnics became fabulous feasts. My father had a whole collection of containers for the picnic fare, and I am not talking about Tupperware or empty ice cream cartons. This was serious food packing and carrying so that his masterpieces arrived completely intact, at the right temperature, and looked scrumptious enough to paint. They were light, crunchy pakoras, perfectly formed samosas, pekoa kachoris, paratas stuffed with spicy potatoes, and chutneys with dips made from imli, tamarind, anardana, pomegranate seeds, mirche, fresh green chilies, dhania, coriander, and a whole mortar of spices. And my mom had to have her cuppa exactly as she liked it. Not for her the traditional, with tea leaves, milk, sugar, water and spices boiled together. She took its separate style. Tea brewed in its pot, with sugar and milk on the side. These were carried with the water kept hot in a flask, complete with my mum's favourite china cup and saucer, and brought out with a flourish when it was time. Always straight after she had eaten her food. Sometimes we didn't take the car, but hired a fleet of dangas, with their ornate carriages as if out of the Roman Empire. With the 2-seaters back to back, there was only room for 3 passengers, including the driver. I was torn between sitting at the front, watching the horse and the tangawala, or at the back, whilst trying not to slip off and fall onto the road, the world flying by at an exhilarating tanga speed. The carriages were decorated by the drivers themselves with paintings of colourful sequins, glitter sparkles or Urdu poetry in calligraphy, the wheels, the arches, even the horse's whip matching. piling in, we perched, holding on to our aromatic fare, the sound of the horse clip-clop, clip-clop, taking us to yet another outdoors adventure. Once, when we reached the park, we leapt off leaving our father, counting out the rupees for the driver. As he followed, he lost his hold on the biryani bucket and it fell in a colourful heap in the middle of the dusty road. Dad rushed over to us, avoiding getting run over, the aromas of the food drifting across. We turned to look longingly at our spilt dinner, and there was an old man in rags wolfing it down. The traffic whizzed by him, but he didn't notice. Ek ek dane par har insaan ka naam likha hua hota hai. Each grain of food has the name of the person it's meant for written on it. An Urdu saying my dad repeated all the time when we used to steal food from each other's plates. That old man had his name engraved all over our biryani that day. My favourite park in Pakistan was the nearest one to us in Rawalpindi, Ayub Park, on the celebrated Grand Trunk Road, which links Pakistan with the Silk Road of the northern frontier. With grounds of over 2,000 acres, it had garden after garden of eastern and western themes, playgrounds, sitting areas and lakes covered in lilies and lotuses. We often hired a boat to float, watching the swans and ducks gliding by us. But the best part was the high teas in the garden restaurant, sitting in the midst of this lush greenery, a distinctive Victorian splendour, complete with impeccably laid out tables of starch white cloth, polished gleaming cutlery, bone china service and cake tiers, loaded with the most melt-in-your-mouth cakes ever eaten in Pakistan. One day, my dad arrived at my school, Holy Purpose, during lesson time. He led me away in silence down the path. It wasn't like Dad to walk so quietly. As we weaved through the park on the way home, he told me my grandfather had passed away suddenly. Later, I watched Babaji in his coffin from the first floor veranda of his house. He looked serene, beautiful, with his long white beard and his magnificent white high turban, the house packed with mourners, women wailing, men praying out loud. That's when my father left. We followed him soon after. My parents wanted us to be educated in England, and then we would go back. That was the plan, like so many other Pakistanis who came here. We struggled. Dad couldn't find a job as an accountant or afford to buy a car to get us to the parks. We moved cities trying to adjust to old smelly houses with cramped spaces. It was too cold for frilly frocks, and I didn't want ribbons in my hair. I wanted it cut short, loose upon my shoulders like English girls. Mum couldn't bear the thought of it, but she gave in the end. In the meantime, we found English parks. In Hyde Park, we sat at Speaker's Corner, eating stuffed bratas with sweet mango pickle, an English discovery. Moving to Yorkshire, we took to getting on the buses, family en masse. We would troop on with new packed British delights. There is a picture in the park, springtime, a picnic spread, us together. Sunshine outlines the colours of the palette. Bright white smile of my father, my two little brothers flushed rosy-cheeked with excitement. My mother's china cup's gold lining. My sisters in flared trousers. Me in my jeans. Dad looks on, satisfied. His last photograph in a park. Mum, now the breadwinner, sold up the old huge terrace house and bought a smaller place with a shop at the front on the main road. Learned to speak English, drive a car, carried her own tea bags, sugar, milk, a small kettle to plug into the car. Running her own business, continued the plan, Good education, respectable jobs were the future. There was no going back. She maintained the family trips to the parks. The first time, in another photograph, we are like Lowry subjects, alone, apart, in a crowd. We are lost, with Dad gone. In photos after his passing, my mother points to the space next to her. Where he should be, she says, always. I live on the edge of Salford now. Old Trafford Cricket Ground on one side, Manchester United on the other. Between two national games and two parks is my doorstep, a place where I belong. Summer is behind us, autumn displays on its way, a parade of changing colours, like an Indian spice box of turmeric yellow, chili reds and cinnamon browns will hold on to the falling leaves and the retreating green. Families, young, old people are out and about, making the most of the September sunshine. They wander, walk, sit, watch in the open, our world in this park of so many colours. Children toddle and dogs follow leads. Asian boys play cricket between the football goalposts in shalwar kameez, skull caps, and some in jeans, t-shirts. Other times, black, white, brown, mixed-race boys play football in teams, and little girls with frocks and ribbons, and others with hijabs, hopscotch, whilst their families sit on blankets spread on grassy areas, having picnics like we did. Pots of curries, mounds of chapatis, whole biradaris sitting around in a circle under the open skies, eating, laughing. Others with sandwiches, crisps and bottles of wine and cans of beer. In the early evening, the older generation walk slowly, resting on the benches they watch the world go by. There's a man who cycles through daily, perched steadily on his bike in his kurta pajama. A topi sits proudly on his head, and his splendid long black beard never moves with the wind as he passes. One time, I watched a group of women all in black walking at speed with purpose, united in rhythm against the blustery weather as the wind carried the sound of their Gujarati. It filled up their burkas like big, fat, round balloons. They were like a flock of birds about to take off. They headed off towards Shrewsbury Street Community Centre, built on the road where Lowry's childhood house was. He was born here on the 1st of November, 1887, at number 8 Barrett Street. He must have walked, maybe even played here, my park, as a toddler, watching the changes of the seasons, as I am doing now. He too had to come to terms with losing a father at a young age, deal with the sudden lack of money, the forced reversals of his family's fortunes. He moved with his mother to Pendlebury, still in Salford, but now he was amongst factories with smoke-filled chimneys, in the streets with no trees or greenery. Later, he said of Pendlebury,
"At first I detested it, and then, after years, I got pretty interested in it, then obsessed by it."
The subjects for his paintings were on his doorstep and on mine. In later life, he recalled this as a sort of vision.
"One day, I missed a train from Pendlebury, a place I had ignored for 7 years. And as I left the station, I saw the Acme Spinning Company's mill, the huge black framework of rows of yellow-lit windows standing up against the sad, damp-charged afternoon sky. The mill was turning out. I watched this scene, which I'd looked at many times without seeing, with rapture."
Lowry worked as the rent collector for a property company. He did not tell people about his work, not wanting to be known as a spare-time painter. But he never gave up his day job, which took him walking all over this city. He made his way through the parks, going from estate to estate, as his new surroundings went through the changes with the Blitz, rebuilding, slum clearances, new housing, his observations captured on canvas. Just a few years before Lowry's work, open spaces in Salford were disappearing with urban development. In 1883, The MP for Bury had spoken in Parliament about the lack of areas for public recreation in his hometown. There were even letters in the Times on the subject.
10th of July, 1846. Sir, what is the use of excessive exclusiveness with regard to parks which used to be considered public? It is enough to make any person's blood boil to see a well-dressed mechanic refused permission into a park considered public. I wish, sir, you would either enlighten me on the subject or attempt some improvement of the aristocratic notions of the men in green.
As a result, the Select Committee on Public Walks reached the conclusion that a place was needed for ordinary people to go to on rest days, in open air and with greenery to relax in. The most prominent supporters of this were the Liberal MP for Manchester, Mark Phillips, and the then Prime Minister, Sir Robert Peel. So, Peel Park in Salford was one of the first public parks to open in England, a glorious space. Several parks were bought for public use in Lowry's lifetime. Even today, there are 20 public parks in Salford. That's over 60% of the city. Lowry has these parks in his paintings again and again. My favourite is the Bandstand. It captures Peel Park full of people. In its centre is the Bandstand, crowded with musicians playing to the workers, circles of them dancing to the music. The movement of the dancers going round, the celebration is there in the dancing loops, surrounded by audiences watching, wishing, swaying. It's a moment caught, how the parks were, the ordinary places ordinary folk went to be. His matchstick men and women promenading, enjoying. Lowry painted not just what he saw, but the future in his painting. It is then, now, and what will be Salford. I am walking here in Buell Hill Park, a long way from my childhood memories. Yet this is where I belong, feel at home, celebrating the proms in the park. People with picnics, loved ones. There is music, laughter, open air. Lowry's Salford, a different century. The rituals remain unchanged.
Park Life was presented by Andrew Malik and was produced by Rebecca Stratford. The reader was Sean Baker. The Proms in the Park events will be celebrating the last night of the Proms on Saturday in Buell Hill Park in Salford and also in London, Hillsborough, Swansea and Dundee. More details on the website. But let me welcome you back to the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. I'm Katie Derham and you join me for a prom which is perhaps the biggest celebration yet of Schumann's bicentenary. Don't forget you can listen again via the website for the next 7 days. And if you are logged in now, you might want to use a new service we're trying out. It's the extra high quality audio stream. You'll see there's a little box you can click on the homepage of the website. It's an experiment, so do please give us your feedback. But back to the music now. And having heard that wonderful introduction and Allegro Appassionato by Schumann just before the interval, it's time now for a new work by Robin Holloway, inspired by and built around, if you like, some of the last songs that Schumann wrote. They were set to texts written by Mary, Queen of Scots. And tonight's conductor, Gian Andrea Noseda, thought they'd make a very good basis for an orchestral work. The man asked to take it on was Robin Holloway, a huge fan of Schumann's music. Born in Leamington Spa in 1943, he had an epiphany as a young composer in the early 70s. He'd been writing music the way he'd been taught to, at Cambridge and at Oxford, which he describes as grey and dreary. The music, that is, not the towns. But then he discovered Schumann and immediately wrote his orchestral scenes from Schumann and fantasy pieces on Schumann's Liederkreis. He'd found his voice, and it was the start of a prolific career. And he compares the epiphany to stumbling on an old Roman road and realizing that this was the way across this landscape that used to be used, that everyone understood, and everyone went that way. And he continues, "Now I can go that way too. Might be a bit overgrown, but it's still the most direct way between two points." Interesting stuff. Earlier, he told us how he approached the Mary, Queen of Scots commission.
I think most lovers of the great Schumann would say this is not one of his happiest works, you know. OK, it's very unhappy in its subject matter, I don't mean that. I mean, it's not very lovely music and it certainly doesn't breathe freely. That incredible lyricism of his youth. They're very claustrophobic and obsessional in the way that all late Schumann is, because that was part of his problem, of his failing powers. But then you think, Mary Queen of Scots, imprisoned, her life under threat. So claustrophobia and limitation and circularity are in fact rather expressive here. And Schumann obviously identified with her in his own virtually imprisoned situation and the sense of, you know, being at the end of his tether somehow. But just to orchestrate it wouldn't have interested me. So I asked if I could amplify the work by at least enclosing it between a prologue and an epilogue, which would open out the material and open out the locked-in emotion, and possibly little numbers between some of the songs, little entr'actes. Fortunately, the BBC bought that idea, and I did it with increasing interest and fascination. The result is a portrait of Mary Queen of Scots in the moods inside the songs, some moods not there at all, like happiness, like looking back to childhood, looking back to her happy days in France, but looking forward equally beyond the songs to her end that we know about, that she doesn't. So it's a portrait of her in many aspects.
Robin Holloway describing this piece to us a little earlier this afternoon. There are five songs that he's written around and arranged, as he explained there. And the five songs are these: Farewell to France, After the Birth of Her Son, To Queen Elizabeth, then Farewell to the World, and finally Prayer. We're going to hear them performed by the BBC Philharmonic with German soprano Dorothea Rüschmann. She made her debut at the 1995 Salzburg Festival as Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro with Nikolaus Harnoncourt, and she has not looked back since. She's soon to appear as the Marschallin in Der Rosenkavalier for Berlin State Opera and Countess Almaviva for Paris Opera and Vienna State Opera. She's won prizes and plaudits for her recordings of Schumann's songs. Well, as we await both our soloist and our conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, tonight, it's worth talking a little bit more about Maestro Nozeda and his relationship with the BBC Philharmonic, which, as I said earlier, is a very close and warm one, which actually will be coming to a close at the end of next season, towards the end of next year. But that round of applause there is for Gianandrea Nozeda and for soloist Dorothea Rüschmann, who will be singing Robin Holloway's Reliquary, a setting of songs by Schumann, set to the text of Mary, Queen of Scots. Robin Holloway's Reliquary, a new arrangement and framework around Schumann's very last songs. Performed there by Dorothea Rirschmann with the BBC Philharmonic and conducted by Gianandrea Nozeda. And composer Robin Holloway is now making his way to the stage to take his bow. It's not the first time his work has been performed here at the Proms, but having spoken to him at the interval, I know he was so looking forward to hearing the interpretation of Gianandrea Nozeda, Dorothea Hirschman, and the BBC Philharmonic this evening, and he seems extremely delighted by the reaction he's getting. The songs, of course, written to texts by the doomed Mary, Queen of Scots, so different from Schumann's earlier outpourings of wonderful Lieder written when he was at his happiest, just married to Clara Wieck. Here, later in his life, he clearly identified with the despair of Mary Stuart, and one writer, an expert on Schumann's songs, said, "We can only conjecture what personal meaning he found in these writings. The first begins, I am going away. The last ends, save me." And soon after he'd written the music to these texts, came his mental breakdown, his attempt to drown himself in the Rhine, and his incarceration in the asylum at Endenich, where in July 1856 he died. A somber theme, but a wonderful work, written by Robin Holloway, setting and arranging and adding to those songs by Schumann. And Robin's back on the stage now, thanking the orchestra. Steve Bernard, the viola player, is getting special thanks from both conductor and composer. And now the whole orchestra on their feet again. And warm thanks from the composer to the soloist, Dorothea Rirschmann, who sang those songs so beautifully. A world premiere here at the Proms. Now, as the orchestra retunes and the stage is tidied up, we can look forward to the last piece of tonight's Prom, the work that Schumann called full of Grecian lightness and grace, Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. It's the middle of the trilogy of symphonies he composed in the space of just 3 months in the summer of 1788. And it's one that always makes a great impact on his listeners, though it does seem to defy description. One critic says he heard the agitation of passion, the regrets of an unhappy love. Another says it's heroically tragic, and both those views seem to contrast with Schumann's. But perhaps that is the magic of Mozart, as tonight's conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, told me earlier.
Great symphony. Sometimes when you have a very famous piece, the risk is, as a performer, to lose the surprise element, because you know the symphony since you were 6, 7 years old. But actually, the symphony is so good, every single time I go back to the score, I find literally 3, 4, 5 new elements, which I've never seen before. So it's incredible. So this is a signal of a great piece of music. When you go back, you think, oh, I know it, and you discover you don't know it yet. You have to spend more time to get closer to that music. And with this symphony, and in general with modern music, is often the case.
Gianandrea Nozeda talking to me earlier. Now, let's put it in the context of Mozart's short but incredibly prolific life. He'd made the move to Vienna from Salzburg 7 years before he wrote this symphony, but he'd already given us The Marriage of Figaro and Don Giovanni, which he wrote with the fabulously rakish ex-priest Lorenzo del Ponte, but he still hadn't got round to Così fan tutti. At this stage, he was still extremely popular. He was probably still suffering from his usual chaotic money troubles. His writing by now was at new heights of textural richness and emotional depth. Extraordinary period of creativity. The 40th Symphony has a wonderful opening, quite an unusual one for the time, as the accompaniment precedes the tune, but then, oh, Wolfgang, always the revolutionary. As with so much of his work, there is a seemingly boundless range of musical meanings, but he brings them together in an ever-changing but completely coherent whole. The BBC Philharmonic, of course, enjoying their annual visit to the proms under their beloved Gianandrea Nozeda, their chief conductor. As I mentioned earlier, it's actually almost his last season with them. He's going to be moving on to wonderful new work. And there is a conductor in waiting, the conductor designate, the Spanish conductor Juanjo Mena. He'll be beginning his tenure in the 2011-2012 season. Next season's highlight, there will be a concert performance of Verdi's Otello, which will be Gianandrea Nozeda's last concert in his current role. This year has been dominated by the Mahler in Manchester Festival, which was staged in collaboration with the city's other orchestras as well. They've had a very busy time. They're about to move house as well. Next year, the BBC Philharmonic moves to a state-of-the-art rehearsal studio at Media City UK in nearby Salford, joining other departments at the BBC's new Northern Hub. I hear it's all looking rather good. They've had a sneak preview. So a very happy time for the orchestra. And here is their conductor, Gianandrea Nozeda, back on stage now to conduct Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor. A stormy allegro rocketing along that last movement there. Energetic performance by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra under Gian Andrea Noseda. Conducting that piece without a baton, he's conducted much of this prom without a baton actually, drawing the sound out of the BBC Philharmonic with his hands. What a delicate fingertip conducting going on, very balletic actually, standing in front of the orchestra. And sometimes almost dancing, indeed, in front of the orchestra as well. He's coming back into the stage now to bring his BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, led today by guest leader Helena Wood, to their feet. And he's shaking almost every member of the orchestra personally by the hand. Mozart's 40th, a piece loved by Schumann, the composer being celebrated here tonight and indeed throughout this season of the Proms during his bicentennial year. Tonight we heard music by him, music inspired by him, and music enjoyed by him. And as Gian Andrea Noseda leaves the stage once more and the BBC Philharmonic take their seats again, it is time for me to say goodnight, but also to remind you that there is, of course, another prom tomorrow, just one, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, with the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardner. Should be a wonderful evening, and you will, of course, be able to hear that live here on BBC Radio 3. I will be back on Saturday on BBC 2, and then indeed on BBC 1, for the last night of the proms. What a night. I do hope you'll join me then. But for now, it is time to hand you back to my colleague John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And remember that the Proms website invites you to submit your own reviews of any concert in the season. It also has details, of course, of all of the Proms in the Park events taking place on the last night this coming Saturday. That all happens at bbc.co.uk/proms. So tomorrow afternoon, there's another chance to hear last Saturday's concert by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and Sir Simon Rattle, with Carita Mattala singing the Strauss Four Last Songs. That's from 2:20 tomorrow afternoon. And then, as we've just heard, tomorrow night, the Royal Albert Hall from 7:30 will be resounding to the music of Monteverdi. Sed corona premium, laudes cadentes martis, absolve ex a Vesper hymn for the Feast of a Martyr, music by Monteverdi from his collection Selva Morale e Spirituale, published in 1641. That was Deus Tuorum Militum. I dare say you may have recognised the voices singing it there, the soprano Emma Kirkby, the tenor Ian Partridge and the bass David Thomas, with the parley of instruments directed by Roy Goodman and Peter Holman. And let me remind you once again of tomorrow night's prom, Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardiner at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Well, back to this evening on Radio 3 with Beethoven Cello Sonata in 45 minutes, performed by one of Radio 3's new generation artists. And then at 11 o'clock, tonight's essay continues our series looking at the meeting of the land, sea and sky. Tonight, it's the turn of the poet Jeremy Hooker, who grew up on the Solent shore and later lived and worked overlooking Cardigan Bay. The essay, tonight on Radio 3 at 11 o'clock. But now, at a little after 9:45, it's time for our feature, Tracking the Aryans. The word Aryan has a long and recently a troubled history, becoming associated with the Nazis' ideology of a blonde, blue-eyed master race. In the Bronze Age, it was a name used by societies in Iran, Pakistan and northern India. But by the 19th century, it had another meaning, referring to the speakers of the prehistoric language Proto-Indo-European, the ancient mother tongue of many languages of Europe and Asia. Well, today the word's negative connotations mean that it's generally avoided. But recent archaeological discoveries on the remote borders of Siberia and Kazakhstan have brought the Aryans to renewed attention. Now on Radio 3, the historian Bettany Hughes journeys to Siberia to see how the discoveries are changing our understanding of prehistory. And she finds out how, even today, the Aryans are being used for modern political ends.
I can honestly say that I have never before travelled on a road like this one. Even though I am a bit bleary, because I flew in from Moscow late last night and then was woken by the brilliance of a blood-orange dawn over the Caspian Sea, I can appreciate the sheer vastness of what lies ahead of me. To the north are the Ural Mountains and to the south, Kazakhstan. But what lies east, and that's the direction that we're travelling in, are just thousands and thousands of miles of steppe grassland, which basically carry on until you hit the Pacific Ocean. And in those grasslands, there's a time bomb. It's an archaeological dig of the very distant past that's being used to politicise and to reconfigure the present. I've got to say that for me, this is a journey that goes way beyond my comfort zone. I'm used to sniffing out evidence of societies through their artefacts and records, right back to the late Bronze Age. But in the terms of written texts, as we travel back beyond 1600 BC, the trail that I'm following today starts to go rather cold. And that is frustrating, because although written words themselves might be conspicuous by their absence, the settlement that I'm heading towards could be a missing link that directs us right back to the origins of the language that you and I speak, a linguistic code that's shared by just over 50% of the world's population today. What I'm seeking out is half of humanity's original mother tongue, Proto-Indo-European. The question of the origins of our language has always been more than just antiquarian curiosity. For some, the logic goes that if we can find the speakers of an ancient tongue that gave birth to the languages spoken by the great cultures of Europe, the Middle East and India, then we find those who could rightly claim to be the fathers of civilization. The search for linguistic ancestry has, as a result, been tenacious and highly charged. Over the last 200 years,
Linguists have demonstrated that the majority of the languages spoken from Ireland all the way to India are part of one linguistic family. English, Greek, Farsi, Sanskrit, Hittite from Anatolia, Tocharian from Western China are all close cousins, all descended from one mainspring tongue. Known today as Proto-Indo-European, its identification begged the question, why was this tongue a Darwinian victor, a language that was somehow strong and fit enough to survive and to propagate? A series of new archaeological excavations on the remote borders of southern Siberia and Kazakhstan may possibly offer up some answers. This region is now being described as the land of the cities, because here the discovery of a series of sophisticated prehistoric settlements, and there may be as many as 20 or so, is rewriting the history of civilization. My destination was one of the most intriguing sites. A city that flourished 36 centuries ago. A place called Arkaim.
So we've been on the road for 7.5 hours and at last we've arrived. It's all slightly disorientating because so far we've driven past a huge mural of Lenin, a derelict windmill, some yurts, and I can hear this strange sound of chanting coming up from the valley. But luckily I've been invited to stay with Professor Stanovic, who's the chief archaeologist here.
Hello, Professor.
Добрый день, дорогие гости. Hello.
I arrived at Arkaim on the day before the summer solstice, and I didn't quite know what to expect. Little has been published about the site, and I'd also heard rumblings of strange goings-on here at this time of year.
Take my shoes off, Russian style, OK?
Yes, yes.
OK, the shoes are going off. Lovely to meet you. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
The professor was keen I shouldn't be drawn to distractions such as distant chanting, and he steered me straight to his archaeological discoveries.
It was 23 years ago, to the very day, that this site was discovered. Do you still remember that moment, Professor?
Я очень хорошо помню.
Дело в том, что я remember it clearly.
Это рассказать сложно.
In the year of 1987, there were construction works here taking place, and they were planning to erect here a river reservoir. A group of our young scientists came here because they knew that the construction works were planned, and they started excavating. There was an airport nearby. The students went up to the sky, took this picture, aerial picture, and suddenly we saw circles here on the land. And at that very moment, Professor knew that it was the Bronze Age. 3 months later, this territory was to be covered with water. Professor took this photograph and went by airplane to Leningrad, St. Petersburg now, so to Professor Petrovsky.
Борис Борисович Петровский.
And Petrovsky had the same reaction to that of Professor Zdanovich. Petrovsky just stopped and made a telephone call to Gorbachev. And in a week, the sky here was full of airplanes, helicopters, and the special commission of the Soviet Ministry, as well as the Academy of Science.
What they'd found was breathtaking. Dated between 2000 and 1600 BC, here was a fortified town laid out in a complex circular form, 200 metres across. A 5-metre-high earth wall with timber gates protected 50 to 60 houses inside. The inhabitants, 2,000 or so of them, left behind intriguing remains. Finely worked copper jewellery, makeup and tattooing equipment, diningware, complex burials, and, crucially, evidence of the earliest known chariot technology. One element absent from the archaeological record, though, was the language spoken by the men and women as they built a life for themselves here.
Indrasya hardyaha vishanne Indrasya sobaradhase shampavastva vitarshane prajabhadreta abhara.
These words could offer a clue. They're lines from one of the oldest surviving texts in any Indo-European language, the Rig Veda of ancient India, composed by a Bronze Age people who seem to have called themselves Aryans. For us, Aryan has become a loaded term, but of course, as archaeologist David Anthony explains, the very last thing we should associate it with is a blonde, blue-eyed master race.
There is another sense of the word Aryan, which is the Aryans of actual prehistory. There really were Aryans, people who referred to themselves as Aryans. The name of the country, Iran, is a version of the word Aryan. And in Iran was the origin of the religion which we call Zoroastrianism. And Zoroastrianism goes back to a religious document called the Avesta, the oldest document in Iranian. And the oldest parts of the Avesta were composed by people who called themselves Aryans. So there are the Aryans of the Avesta. And the Aryans who composed the oldest parts of the Avesta, probably about 1200 BC, were related to other Aryans who composed the religious documents that are at the root of Hinduism. The composers of the Rig Veda also referred to themselves as Aryans. So the Aryans of the Rig Veda and the Aryans of the Avesta were real people, but they lived in what is today Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, northern India, between 1500 and 1000 BC. You can really refer to those Aryans and you're talking about real people. But they should not be confused with the Aryans of propaganda who exist only in the minds of nationalists and politicians and racists.
What are we walking along now? We seem to be striding out through the grass and the shrub.
We are now going along the outer wall of Akraim, and it's about 1 meter high over the steppe. In ancient times, it would be about 5 meters high.
So it's a fortified settlement. But who is it protecting? Who's living here?
Indo-European people used to live here. Their old perception is reflected in the burials. That is, chariots which were put, sacrifices, and so on. And it can be also reflected in Rig Veda texts.
Tell me how you equate the two, because the Rig Veda texts are obviously very ancient hymns. What reflection of those do you see in the archaeology here?
Rig Veda texts were written by poets, and they had special rituals, and they sang hymns to gods. We find these rituals, and we excavate the traces of these rituals of the natural form, the way they were.
That's so fascinating. So what you're saying is that you can see the myths and the stories of the religious texts made flesh in the archaeology that you're digging up here at Akraim.
That's
it. One of the traditions that's continued, absolutely unchanged in this region, is a love of horses, of horse racing, and of riding in chariots and wagons. And because of that, I've been offered a lift by a man who's turned up clearly because of the midsummer solstice activities here, hoping to try to tout for a bit of custom, and he's given me a ride along the steps. It's actually immensely appropriate because what he probably doesn't realise is that the first ever extant chariot was discovered very close to here. It dates back to around 2000 BC. And so we know from the archaeology that the culture that lived here were very fond of their horses. In fact, when a great man died, his horse would be sacrificed and buried with him along with the chariot. Now, what's fascinating is that that practice, which we're finding hard evidence of in the archaeology, matches up exactly with lines from the Rig Veda. Just listen to this. This is Rig Veda 1:162. keep the limbs undamaged and place them in the proper pattern. Cut those limbs of the horse apart, calling out piece by piece. And then once the animal was killed, the flesh would be distributed amongst those around. Those who see that the racehorse is cooked, who say, it smells good, take it away, and who wait for the doling out of the flesh of the charger, they are glad. And then this ceremony will be finished off with grand prayers. Let us speak great words as men of power in the sacrificial gathering. It's just so tantalising because we cannot yet be sure that that language that they used was indeed the direct ancestor of the words that I'm speaking today. Trying to tally fragmentary archaeology with a remote language is, of course, precarious. Plenty of opportunity to turn a possibility into a certainty. Pitfalls ever-present, it seems, when it comes to tracking Aryans. David Anthony.
In the 19th century, as European nations were trying to make themselves, some of them began to adopt the idea that they were descended from the original speakers of Proto-Indo-European, and they made a mistake and identified the original speakers of Proto-Indo-European as Aryans. And they did this largely because the Vedas and the Avesta were newly discovered. They were just being translated into Western languages. They were objects of fascination. People talked about them in their parlors, in Victorian homes. There were articles about these new texts in 19th century newspapers and popular literature. And the name Aryan was attached to these Eastern texts, the Avesta and the Rig Veda. And because it was popular, that name became applied to the people who spoke Proto-Indo-European, the original language from which all of the Indo-European languages are descended. But in fact, the Aryan languages, the Indo-Iranian languages, are a daughter. They are not the mother. Nevertheless, the mistake was made in the popular literature, so the Aryans of propaganda were born in that way and were regarded as the ultimate source from which all Indo-European languages descended, something that all linguists of the time realized was an error.
There may have been confusion about who the Aryans were, but the study of texts such as the Avesta and the Rig Veda catalyzed a revolution in linguistics. It meant that the search for the speakers of Proto-Indo-European wasn't just done via excavations, but by a kind of archaeology on the language itself. James Mallory of Queen's University Belfast explains how.
One reconstructs by comparing words in the different languages and the grammars of the different languages, so that when you find, for example, we say a BH in Sanskrit, for example, in the word bratar, which means brother, we will find an F in Latin, which gives us our word frater, for example. In English, of course, it is brother, and it's the same word. And if you went through a list of the commonest terms, like kinship and things like that, you would see immediately at least a surface resemblance between even English, modern English, and ancient Sanskrit, or many of the other ancient languages of the Indo-European world. And the fact of the matter is that the reason why these words are similar is because they derive from this common language. Now, getting back to the common language, what the linguist does is they establish the rules between each of the different Indo-European languages. It produces a ballpark reconstruction of what the word might have originally sounded like. One of the things I think linguists have, you know, always imagined in the back of their heads is that if they had a phrase book written in Proto-Indo-European and they were thrown back something like 5,000 years, what chance would they have of making themselves understood? I suspect that most of them imagine badly, but they might just about get the ideas across.
Time travel might not be a possibility, but an actual journey to Central Asia today does help you to imagine how those snatches of Proto-Indo-European that have been identified could have evolved. In a pastoral culture where men and women drove their herds through this continuous landscape, it makes perfect sense that a code of behaviour had to be developed. If you saw another group of humans appearing as tiny dots in the distance, your options were either to destroy them or to try to deal with them peaceably. And it seems that the early Bronze Age communities here plumped for the latter. Linguists tell us that around 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, an important concept was nurtured here. It was an ethical code, if you like, gusti, a notion that gives us both the words guest and host. Gusti also endures through to the Greek world as xenia, Homer's guest-host friendship. And it was a vital factor in the survival of all cultures in the Bronze Age. Basically, it meant that when you travelled, when you met strangers, you could presume that they were friends and not foe. And that allowed for men and women to exchange ideas and experiences. It allowed civilization itself to thrive. And just a little point of information. We remember gusti today not just in our originally interchangeable words of guest and host, but also in the word ghost. Because, of course, a ghost is a visitor, someone that can either be appreciated or a visitor who is slightly less welcome.
The reconstructions give us other hints about the speakers of Proto-Indo-European. Archaeologist David Anthony.
We know that they were violent at times. There's quite a bit of reconstructed vocabulary referring to violence and fighting. We know that they had institutions built around hospitality. We know that their gods inhabited the sky. Most of them were male. They seem to have had a principal deity who was referred to as Father Heaven or Father Sky, and is the basis for the Roman god Jupiter and the Greek god Zeus. They had another god who was seen as related to war and thunder, which is the basis for Thor, for instance, in Germanic mythology. And they had another god, which was the divine twins, a dual deity, who are associated with good luck and good fortune and finding the way of people or animals who are lost.
Without even leaving the library, the linguists seem able to make discoveries that archaeologists dream of. But not everyone agrees on how much you can read into reconstructed words. James Mallory.
Normally, the more interesting the term, the more controversial the reconstruction is going to be. For example, we can reconstruct certainly in a number of European languages, and we believe, or many people believe, that you can also use Sanskrit here to reconstruct the word for king. Now, the problem is, what does that mean in terms of a prehistoric society? We know what rex means in ancient Latin, or rix in the Celtic language of ancient Gaul, but what that might have meant several thousand years before that as a word, we find it very difficult to know precisely what that might mean. Because some of the things that you're going to be reconstructing may have existed in Proto-Indo-European, and some of the things may be just the generic developments that we might expect among any group of people.
Back at Archaim, there's further evidence that teasing out meaning from across the centuries is a perilous business. The prehistoric inhabitants here may not have developed the written word, but they did leave us one particularly potent symbol, the so-called swastika. Now tarnished by its Nazi appropriation as a symbol of an Aryan master race, this was in fact a sign of the sun that can be found in Bronze Age sites all over India, China, the Middle East and Southern Europe.
Elementy swastiki na Archaim, безусловно, есть.
There are some elements of swastikas here.
Есть поселения, которые построены.
And he says that there are some settlements which were built according to the swastika shape.
Мы можем завтра на одно из таких поселений заехать.
I know that the swastika is this very ancient symbol. It's a very ancient religious symbol. Is that why you think these settlements are being built in that shape for some kind of ritual purpose?
В этом можно не сомневаться.
It is undoubtful. It goes without saying So that this symbol was very important for those times.
Вы знаете, свастика – это вершина символического мышления человека.
Swastics was a symbol, it was a top of mythological philosophy. That is, it's something that means the unity between man and nature, something that we really lack nowadays.
Do you think that some people come to Akureyim, like this weekend, for the Summer Solstice Festival, for the wrong reasons, that they come because swastikas are everywhere, and that's somehow feeding a political anger, rather than them coming and understanding it as an ancient religious symbol?
This fact cannot be excluded, as so many people are coming here. But he says that worldwide, archaeology attracts a lot of people nowadays and people of different religions. That's why there could be...
We're just back from the site of Akureyim, and we were looking at the remains well into the dark. It's clear that the professor's obsession and his life's work is understanding the Bronze Age archaeology here. But also, he's well aware that he's dealing with very charged material. Because there were swastikas found here, both around the site and actually within it, on the pots of the people who lived here, it is going to be impossible to keep this kind of archaeology absolutely remote from contemporary politics. And there's hard evidence of that fact in the site's museum. The museum's been recently renovated, and up at the top of the rather fine marble stairs here, there's a huge poster showing Putin looking at a... Is that a Bronze Age pot that he's looking at?
Yeah.
And our politicians were much interested in it.
Why did they come here?
Medvedev... Он был здесь в апреле 2005 года.
President Medvedev was here in April of 2005.
Да, он не говорил, что они с Владимиром Владимировичем Путиным,
они together with Vladimir Putin have meals together quite often. However complicated the day was, all their conversations always ended in where we should lead Russia, where Russia should be guided. And what kind of idea should be to unite this movement? And professor supposes that that is why they came here.
Do you know what an impact it had on Putin coming here? Do you know how it affected his thinking?
После его посещения я слышал несколько высказываний.
After his visit to Akureyim, Professor Zdanovich heard some of his speeches, that is Putin's speeches when he was in India, and he was saying that according to the opinion of some scientists, India and Russia are united by some common roots.
Вы задали очень сложный вопрос.
We are aiming at.
Но это просвещение наших лидеров.
At educating our leaders.
Я не говорю, что они не.
I don't mean that they are uneducated, but as far as our ancient history is concerned, which unites all our Russian peoples, I suppose that such kind of educating our leaders, our deputies, is necessary.
You're refining their education. We mustn't forget that Akureyim was discovered at a key moment in modern history. Communism had collapsed, Russian judgment was under fire, and about turn to the West looked to be the nation's only salvation. So to discover evidence of an ancient, sophisticated civilization, and one that seemed to have Aryan traits, was really too good to be true. Russian pride could be reclaimed. Akureyim became legend almost as soon as it became history. Which was why, although I knew very little about the archaeological digs here, Akureyim's reputation preceded it. Because, and one senses much